My guest today, Mark Weisbrot, is co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. The center was founded in 1999 by Weisbrot and Dean Baker to promote democratic debate on the most important economic and social issues that affect people's lives, and that is something that is desperately needed these days more than ever. He is also president of Just Foreign Policy, an independent nonpartisan membership organization dedicated to reforming U.S. foreign policy by mobilizing and organizing the broad majority of Americans who want a foreign policy based on diplomacy, law, and cooperation. Another worthy and equally daunting task. Mark Weisbrot is co-author with Dean Baker of Social Security, The Phony Crisis, published by University of Chicago Press in 2000, and has written numerous research papers on economic policy. His opinion pieces have appeared in the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Boston Globe, among others, and the Guardian of London, where his op-ed piece of May 31st entitled, quote, "Europeans' economic future has been hijacked by dangerous ideologues," caught my eye, and I immediately contacted him to be my guest again on Takes on the World. He was last here on July 2009 when we discussed the U.S.-backed coup in Honduras. Welcome once again, Mark Weisbrot, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that the title of your Guardian article caught my attention was because I thought, somewhat naively, that it was only America's future that was being hijacked by dangerous ideologues. Who are these ideologues in Europe, and what's their agenda?
Well, they're kind of worse in a way, in the sense that, you know, you imagine the House Republicans running all three branches of government. I guess that's more what it's like there, because you have the European Central Bank and the European Commission and the IMF. They're referred to in the press as the Troika, and they're really deciding economic policy for the Eurozone, and especially the countries that are in trouble, Greece, Spain, Ireland, Portugal, Italy. So their agenda is they really want to roll back as much as they can what is, in Europe is called the welfare state, which is, you know, people there have more social protections, stronger unions, and more equal distribution of income than we have here. And they want to make it more like the United States in terms of where the rich get a lot more. Workers have much fewer rights.
Well, this began actually, this attack on workers' benefits and welfare programs began at the end of the Cold War, actually, didn't it? When with the collapse of the Soviet Union and East Bloc, there was no longer workers, quote, worker states to compete against, or at least countries that provided more workers' benefits than did the West. And in competition, up to that point, Germany, particularly in the Western European countries, had provided excellent benefits for their workers because they had to do that. They saw them having to do that. Is this part of a continuing war against the public, the welfare of the public?
There's no doubt that it is right now. I mean, that's the trouble, is that the Eurozone, the Euro was created and went into effect in 2000. And it was, you know, the European Union was not like this. You know, the European Union has 27 countries, and they had been expanding trade and commerce for years, but not in a way that really, you know, it wasn't like NAFTA. It wasn't designed to push down the wages of workers or anything like that. And in fact, you know, you had a lot of wage growth during the whole post-World War II period in Europe. It slowed down some, but it wasn't as drastic as what we had even, for instance, in the United States after 1973, when the, you know, typical wages kind of stopped growing over the last 35 years. And so what happened, though, was the Eurozone was created under different principles. These principles were much more conservative. And so, for instance, they created a central bank, and the central bank's responsibility was to keep very low inflation, and it didn't really have any responsibility with regard to employment. And, you know, since the central bank is the most important institution in terms of controlling the rate of growth and employment in the economy, that was a very big setback. And, of course, you know, Europe did okay from 2000 to 2008, but when the world financial crisis hit, then you see the way the adjustment takes place in Europe is much more brutal than it is even in the United States. They're basically squeezing these countries and trying to, they're shrinking them. They're literally forcing them to shrink. Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, they're all in recession. And the rest of the whole region has been pushed into recession now. And Europe-wide unemployment is 11%. Again, that's noticeably worse than here. And it's because they're really, they don't want to, the European Central Bank doesn't want to resolve the crisis just yet, because they're using it to force these regressive changes on these countries that they would never vote for. For example, I was just in Spain 2 weeks ago, where the government cut €7 billion out of healthcare spending. They have a very good healthcare system, and that would be like cutting out a quarter of Medicaid here in the United States. That's what the European authorities want them to do. And so it happens right now they have a right-wing government too, which likes doing that as well. So it's an even deadlier combination. But you see this all across the Eurozone. Now they're cutting pensions. The public pension system is equivalent of our Social Security. They're cutting the minimum wage. In Greece, they cut the minimum wage by 20% and 25% for people under, 25. They're just doing all these things that people don't want, and they're using the crisis in order to justify that.
Well, according to like Joseph Stiglitz and some other economists, there was an inherent problems with the Eurozone, and that they were not prepared for an economic crisis. In any case, validity in that? Is the Eurozone realistic from the beginning?
Well, that's a tougher question. I mean, if you mean, there's structural problems with it too. When you have a common currency for countries that have different levels of productivity, then, imagine if the United States had a common currency with, countries in Latin America, for example. They're too different. It wouldn't really work because their productivity is different. So you would end up with big trade imbalances. And that's basically what happened in Europe, because normally your currency adjusts in order to adjust trade imbalances. If you're running a big trade deficit, your currency falls and your exports become cheaper, your imports become more expensive, and that's how the adjustment takes place. But when you have just one currency for everybody, that doesn't happen. So there's a question of whether these countries were just too different in terms of their productivity to have a currency union. But I think that's a secondary question, because I wouldn't say that's necessarily true. The big problem is that they ran into a recession for the same reasons that we did, really. There was a big worldwide bubble in the financial sphere. There was a housing bubble in the United States. There were big housing bubbles in Spain and Ireland and the UK. And, all of this burst. And the problem is that instead of having a stimulus like we had here, which wasn't big enough, but at least it helped a little bit. I mean, more than a little, it helped significantly. They went in the other direction. They did kind of what, the Republicans would like to do here, which is they cut spending, tighten the budgets, and they push the economy into a second recession 3 years after the first one.
How much of this current recession in Europe can be traced back to the subprime lending problem, dilemma we have?
Part of it is, because that's what threw them into recession back in 2009. But they could have recovered from that, and we recovered some. Like I said, I don't want to use the U.S. as a good example because, as Paul Krugman says, this is kind of like a depression. Even though we've been growing, we're officially out of the recession for 3 years now. It feels like a recession to most people because unemployment is so high. Well, imagine that we did worse than that. Imagine we did at the federal level what the state and local governments are doing, which is what's really hurting our economy the most. And that is, we just had the federal government be cutting spending while the economy is shrinking. That's what they did in Europe, and that's what they're still doing, and that's the fundamental problem.
Well, we see Greece, for example, which is not as a critical member of the Eurozone, is going to have an election in 4 days, and there's a strong likelihood that the voters there will vote for the Syriza party, which will then decide that the austerity being imposed upon them by the European zone, the Eurozone, is too much and will take Greece, in fact, out of the euro and back to the drachma. That will at least enable them to print money. But what effect would that have on the overall European economy, or is Greece not too big to fail, so to speak?
Well, the Syriza party is not going to pull Greece out of the euro. They, in fact, the head of the party, the candidate for the one who was at the top of the ticket and still is, Alexis Tsipras, had an op-ed in the Financial Times yesterday when that was the headline of it, Greece is not going to leave the euro. So, now that's not to say it can't happen, but they wouldn't deliberately pull out. What they're saying is they want to renegotiate the February agreement with the Troika, with the IMF and the European authorities, which is the one that imposed all these terrible conditions, including the minimum wage cuts and the other budget cuts, and the things that, you know, they're cutting healthcare spending and pushed their economy further into recession and made a mess. And they don't want that agreement. And that's what people voted for. So I'm not saying they shouldn't leave the euro or they never will, but I think the markets are certainly exaggerating the probability that they'll actually leave.
Well, Syriza party and Syriza is using that as a negotiating ploy, actually, because the Eurozone would prefer Greece staying in, but the austerity package that's been forced upon the Greek people has obviously been rejected by the public. It seems every government where there's been an election in France has fallen. Are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Has fallen. We saw that in France. It doesn't matter who is in charge. They throw so-called the rascals out. Now, Spain just got $125 billion, $100 billion euro bailout, but that's not going to go to the people. That's going to go to the banks, right?
Yes.
How is that going to help the Spanish economy?
Well, it does help resolve a very severe crisis in the banking system, where the banks basically didn't have enough capital. And so it will help some. It won't resolve it won't help the people immediately or directly. And the problem is, again, Spain is cutting its spending and shrinking its economy.
Well, we saw when the banks were bailed out here in the United States, they didn't start turning around and lending. They held on to the money. Is there any guarantee that the Spanish banks are going to start lending that money that they've just been received from the Eurozone? Is there any contingency or commitment that they've made to do that?
No, and that's the problem. But I think the overall problem is not so much they don't want to lend as they don't have. There's not enough demand in the economy, so the businesses are not borrowing either.
And the employment rate there is 25% overall. It's even more for the youth, no?
Yes, it's about half. It's quite terrible. And again, they're shrinking the economy. And, you know, the worst thing about the bailout in terms of its immediate effect is it didn't even resolve the crisis in Spain, because the Spanish bond yields, the Spanish sovereign debt, that is the government debt, the yields on those bonds bounced right back up after initially it dropped, both in anticipation and response to the bailout. And then they went right back up because the markets are still worried that it won't resolve the ongoing crisis in Spain, even if it resolved the most immediate problem of the undercapitalization of the bank.
And they have to have those rates high, otherwise people aren't going to buy the bonds.
Well, basically, the way the bond markets work is, yes, I mean, bonds are traded constantly, and the price goes in the opposite direction of the yield, the interest rate. So if the 10-year bond prices, people start selling them, then the yield goes up.
Now, turning to Italy, which is a major economy in the Eurozone, Italy, too, is on the brink of economic disaster. What can the Eurozone do if one country after another runs into problems? Certainly Germany, which has carried the major load, there'll be increased resistance within Germany to keep this up. There's been a long time a conflict, you know, between Germany and Italy, the culture and so on. But what happens if Italy also asks for a bailout, which is, seems quite likely?
Well, I see, here's the problem. It's actually simpler than most people think. The problem with Italy and Spain is not that they have too big of a public debt. The problem is that the markets, through mostly speculation and people selling their bonds, they're pushing their borrowing costs up. Now, that doesn't make that much of a difference immediately. So, for instance, you know, Spain has like an €800 billion debt. So that would be about $1 trillion. And they, only about one-tenth of that is due this year. So if they have to sell some bonds at a slightly, a somewhat higher rate, at 6.5%, or even 7 instead of 5, that doesn't make that much difference. So what the bonds are really, the markets are really anticipating, it's kind of a snowball effect. You know, they start selling, and then more people start selling, and it's like the opposite of a bubble. It's, you know, it's just a collapse. And the real problem is very simple. The European Central Bank could intervene at any time and stop this from happening. All they have to do is do kind of what our Federal Reserve did here when they bought all those U.S. Treasury bonds, and they bought the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac securities. They can do that too, and it doesn't cost anything to the for the taxpayer for them to do that. But they won't do it because they literally don't want the crisis to end, because they want to force Spain and Italy to make these changes that the people don't want. So that's the real problem. It's all because the central bank won't do its job. Our central bank, of course, hasn't done everything it could do to resolve the crisis here or is to get us out of recession, but they did a lot. They did a lot more than the European Central Bank is willing to do, and that's the difference.
Who's in charge of the European Central Bank?
Well, it's an independent. It's nominally independent, so it's got a board that's appointed by the governments, and they don't even have to listen to the governments.
So essentially what you're saying is that the goal of this recession, it's being driven by the desire to permanently crush the unions and dismantle essentially what has a bad name in this country, the welfare state, an economy that has a strong safety net and provides health benefits and good labor benefits for its workers.
Yes, and it's not a conspiracy. I mean, you can see this. You know, it's not as though they didn't engineer the recession. The recession comes by itself. What they're doing is making it worse, and because they want to cut these budgets. And they're also refusing, what they're refusing to do is just as important. They're refusing, the financial markets can, you know, they do destabilize things because you have all kinds of people who are betting. They're betting on the collapse of the euro. They're speculating against the euro. They're speculating against these banks. They're taking money out of Spain. And they're taking money out of the Spanish and Italian bonds. And what I'm saying is that the European Central Bank has the ability to stop this. It's very easy for them to do it because they can overpower the private markets. They have so much more money. And they don't have to do very much. You know, they did this in November, and they did it in August. And all they did was buy some of these Italian bonds when that was the problem in November. And sure enough, as soon as they start to buy, then the private sector starts buying because the price is going up. So it's very easy for them to put an end to the immediate crisis. And that's the part where I say it's deliberate. They don't want to do that because they want to force these changes.
Now, this is already having an effect on the American economy and quite likely or quite possibly on our presidential elections. But certainly the Obama administration, which has seen European or American exports to Europe fall because Europe is a major market. What is the Obama administration doing and what impact do you think this will have on the November elections?
Well, the Obama administration is putting as much pressure as they can on Europe, both publicly and behind the scenes, to not continue on this path and to make sure that it doesn't get worse, and also to just try to stabilize things and restore growth. But he's not having that much impact so far. I think he's had some. I think that it's possible that they bailed out the Spanish banks earlier than they would have. It's hard to say because we don't know everything that's going on behind the scenes, but we do know that, you know, he sent his assistant secretary of the Treasury over to Europe 18 times in the last 2 years. That's Lael Brainard. She's under secretary of the Treasury for International Affairs. And Tim Geithner has gone there in the past, and Obama himself has made a point out of this. So can it hurt his reelection chances? Absolutely, because it does affect world markets. It affects the stock market, which even though most people in the United States have very little or even nothing in the stock market at all, even in their retirement funds, is nonetheless, you know, the stock market is kind of headline news. And then, and of course, there's still a large number of people who do have money in the stock market, and some of them are swing voters. So they can easily swing the election as well if it's even reasonably close.
My guest is Mark Weisbrot. It's now 14 minutes before, 12 minutes before the hour. If you have any comments or questions, the number here, of course, is 895-2448. There's been some other suggestions, and one of them made that the Europeans form a European political union, which would involve or require surrendering a considerable amount of their sovereignty, of each country's sovereignty. Is that a realistic proposal at this point in time?
Well, I mean, I think that there will be. They're moving all the time towards more coordination and giving. They're not really surrendering much of their sovereignty, but they've increased the amount of funds available for what happened in Spain. You know, the European Financial Stability Facility. They've also increased their coordination, and they've done some things that are going to make things worse, but are collectively acting, such as the. The fiscal pact that they signed in December, which commits them to basically balancing their budget. So the problem is not so much a lack of coordination as it is the wrong policies. That's the real problem. They've got to change their policies to policies that would stimulate growth and employment rather than the opposite.
Well, it's interesting. People may wonder, where does the IMF come into this? And you recently wrote an article just a few days ago about the perverse, what you call the perverse praise for Latvia's economic, quote-unquote, success by the new IMF chief, Christian Lagarde. Maybe you could comment on that. Will that be used as an example and a bad example for the rest of Europe?
Well, that's why I wrote that, because this is the first time you have mainstream people like Christine Lagarde and a couple of economists actually saying, well, maybe Latvia was successful because they tried a similar thing that they're trying to impose in Greece and in Portugal and Ireland and Spain, Italy. And they had a terrible, terrible recession, the worst in the whole world in 2008 and 2009. And then they began to recover. So they grew last year, the economy grew. They're saying, well, it worked. But it didn't really work in the sense they still have 16% unemployment, and they had the worst loss of output in the whole world. And so it was a disaster. And the problem is that when people try to say, well, because the economy finally started to grow again, that this works, then that has very dangerous implications for the stubbornness of the European authorities in trying to force these countries to stay the course and just stay in recession for as long as it takes, which could be years.
You were in Spain, which has had a major protest, as did Greece. What do you feel are the possibilities at some point of major mobilizations that will go beyond anything we've seen so far in terms of the people saying essentially, no, we're not going to take this anymore? And how likely do you think that to happen?
It's tough because, you know, nobody wants to leave the euro is the problem. I mean, very few people want to even talk about it. And that's a big difficulty because it's not that these countries necessarily have to leave the euro, but they have to have a credible threat of doing so, or they may have to have a credible threat in order to force the European authorities to change course. I mean, we'll see what happens in Greece, if it even works there. But yeah, there's been a lot of mobilization in Spain. There's been hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. They have a huge movement. It's called N15. And, you know, they put out a list of demands. And, for instance, you've got all these empty buildings. They had a big housing bubble that was bigger than ours. And so you have all these apartments that are unfilled. They want the state to take it over and provide housing for the homeless.
Evidently, there's like 700,000-800,000 of vacant homes that were built and nobody's lived in them.
Yeah, I think it's even more than that. And and the public supports them too in the polls. Unfortunately, the right wing party won the last election, so they're just concentrating on taking things away from people.
Now, Britain is not in the euro, but is affected, of course, very much by what happens in Europe. What's happening with the British economy?
Well, they're actually doing the same thing, and they're in recession as well. And the ironic thing about it is that's the right-wing government that's doing that. They don't have to. They're not getting any pressure because they're not part of the eurozone, so they can't even blame it on anyone else. And the interesting thing is, you know, they don't have that problem with the bond yields because they have their own central bank, and they're not in their own currency. You know, even though their economy is in trouble and has a much higher debt than Spain, nobody's pushing up the yields on their bonds. They can borrow 10-year bonds at 1.8% as opposed to, you know, 6.5% in Spain. So they have the ability by themselves to get out of the recession without having to fight with the eurozone and without having to remove themselves from a currency union, both of which are extremely difficult for the eurozone countries. And yet their government is taking a similar course right now. It's really irrational and stupid. And I don't know how long they're going to keep doing it because, there's going to be a lot of resistance to that.
This is like Thatcher Redux.
It is, in a way, yeah. I mean, in terms of what they're doing to the economy.
Well, actually, all this argues, in fact, against a eurozone, a common currency, because the United States and Britain, in fact, can print money. Whereas in Europe, countries such as Greece or Spain or Italy no longer can put out pesetas or lira like they did before. Is there something that in the long run that's going to keep the eurozone together if the situation keeps going like this? You say it can be stopped by the powers that be there, the European Central Bank, at a certain point, but do you think they will?
Do I think the UK will, or who will?
No, the European Central Bank will actually at some point realize that the thing is, if they've gone as far as they can go in pushing for breaking the unions and destroying the social contract between the governments and their people.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's the question everybody wants to know. If you look at what they've done over the last 2 years, they repeatedly push the economy to the financial markets to the brink of a more serious meltdown, and then they back off. That's what they just did with Spain. Even, you know, they finally put some money in to recapitalize the banks, but they're still, they still haven't resolved the other parts of the immediate crisis. I think, if I had to bet, I think they will slowly move in the direction of getting out of this. I do think that. But there's no guarantee. I mean, they've really been playing with fire for a long time now. And they could mess things up a lot worse.
And there'll be an impact, of course, here where every week close to 400,000 people apply for unemployment benefits and don't find jobs either immediately or at all.
Yeah, it will. Well, obviously, if it gets really bad, if you have an actual financial meltdown, that will really have a huge impact on the U.S. economy. And but it's having an impact. It's slowing the whole world economy, even as it is right now.
Well, Mark, thanks for sharing your optimism with us today, your report on the European economy. People can read your articles where?
At CEPR.net.
That's CEPR.net. That stands for the Center for Economic Policy Research. I know you've been writing a number of articles in The Guardian of London, which is one of the better international papers available online. And I recommend to the listeners to go and read some of those columns. They're very instructive, as was the one that I read, or the last two I read, which before I called you. Well, we've reached the end of the program. Well, again, I want to thank you again for sharing your thoughts with us, and we'll keep posted on what you're writing and hope to have you back again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.